From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we're featuring her interviews with two nominees for this month's National Book Awards. First, Tobias Wolff discusses his new Vietnam memoir, In Pharaoh's Army. It's a follow-up to his acclaimed memoir, This Boy's Life. Then we hear from Howard Norman, author of The Bird Artist, a novel set in Newfoundland in 1911 about a painter who's committed murder. Norman's previous novel, The Northern Lights, was also nominated for a National Book Award. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Joni Mitchell's latest album. All that coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A hijacker who took over a Norwegian domestic airline flight has been taken into custody by police. The hijacker is thought to be Bosnian and had made several demands for humanitarian aid to be sent into Sarajevo. Norwegian radio reports have not elaborated on the condition of the hijacker. He said he wasn't alone, but Norwegian police believe he was. They also said he was armed with a hand grenade. A large rescue and salvage operation has been going on in southern Egypt after one of the worst disasters there in recent memory. A fierce storm that set off a fire in a fuel depot sent blazing flood water surging through a town. Officials fear the number of people killed could reach 600. Simon Ingram reports from Cairo.
A second day of rescue work in the stricken village of Durunka brought grim evidence of the scale of the catastrophe. Eyewitnesses say an area covering several square kilometers now resembles a muddy battlefield, strewn with the burned remains of houses and trees. Many of the victims were incinerated in their homes when floodwaters swept thousands of tons of burning oil through the streets. More bodies are thought to be still buried in the debris. Some of the survivors who fled Durunka returned to search for missing relatives and rescue their possessions. For many, it proved a fruitless task. Prime Minister Atif Sidki and other officials visited the scene and pledged immediate compensation for families affected. But there's been criticism of the government for keeping such a large store of fuel so close to the village.
The BBC's Simon Ingram reporting. A new poll shows Republican Congressman Rick Santorum is pulled ahead of Democratic incumbent Harris Wofford in the Pennsylvania Senate race. Vicky Quay of member station WHYY reports.
A month ago, when Pennsylvania voters were sampled, results showed the two candidates in a dead heat. But a poll released today by a Philadelphia newspaper and television station shows Santorum now leading Wofford by 10 percentage points. The survey's margin of error is 5%, and nearly a fifth of the registered voters sampled remain undecided. That's why political analysts still consider the contest close. They say Wofford's recent television ads attacking Santorum for wanting to raise the age of eligibility for Social Security from 65 to 70 have proven effective. Pennsylvania has the second highest number of senior citizens in the country. For National Public Radio, I'm Vicky Quay in Philadelphia.
The search for two missing South Carolina boys has prompted a flurry of activity in Macon, Georgia. Macon authorities say an elderly man reports he saw a car matching the description of the one stolen in Union, South Carolina last week. Susan Smith says her sons were in the car when a man forced her out and drove away, with the boys still strapped in their car seats. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 5 points. This is NPR. Islamic militants in Gaza have evicted PLO leader Yasser Arafat from a mosque. He was attending a funeral of a Muslim activist who was killed by a car bomb. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Yasser Arafat came to pay his respects at the funeral of Hani Abad, a member of the Islamic Jihad group. Palestinians close to Arafat say that Islamic Jihad supporters shouted Arafat is a collaborator, knocked off his black and white headscarf, and pushed him out a back door of the mosque into the pouring rain. The incident showed the increasing tensions between the PLO, which has reached an interim peace deal with Israel, and the Islamic militants who oppose all negotiations with Israel. Palestinians say that Israeli security services killed Hani Abad and vowed to revenge his death with attacks in Tel Aviv. Arafat has been caught in a difficult position between demands from Israel to crack down on extremists and trying to co-opt them into his self-rule authority. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Ingrid Duran says her husband would never have tried to kill the president. Duran's husband, Francisco, was charged with firing a barrage of shots at the White House last Saturday. Mrs. Duran told the Colorado Springs Gazette-Telegraph that her husband didn't like the government, but that he would never take another life because it was against his principles. Federal officials say they're considering whether to file attempted assassination charges against Duran. One of his former co-workers says he'd heard Duran say he was going to take out the president. KB Toy Stores has started burning tons of realistic-looking toy guns. Store officials say 120 tons of guns will be sent to a Massachusetts plant that turns trash into energy by burning it. KB Toys is one of several retailers that have decided to stop selling toy guns because of incidents of children being shot by police who thought the guns were real. A store spokesman says it'll take 2 weeks to destroy all the guns, and when the burning is finished, they'll produce enough heat to light 48 homes for a month. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with writer Tobias Wolff. If you had known Wolff during the time covered in his new memoir, you'd probably be quite surprised at the course his life has taken since then. Wolff's new book, In Pharaoh's Army, is about his tour in Vietnam. He joined the Army after he was kicked out of a prep school he had gotten into by forging letters of recommendation. He became a first lieutenant, but by his own account was a lousy officer. Today, Tobias Wolff is waiting to see if his new memoir will win the National Book Award. His earlier novel, The Barracks Thief, won a Penn Faulkner Award, and the memoir of his childhood, This Boy's Life, won the L.A. Times Book Award. It was made into a movie with Ellen Barkin as his mother and Robert De Niro as his abusive stepfather. Wolff has also won awards for his short story writing, and he edited two recently published short story collections, The Best American Short Stories for 1994 and The Vintage Book of Contemporary American Short Stories. Terry Gross recorded this interview with Wolff earlier this week. He began with a reading from his new memoir.
The men I'd respected when I was growing up had all served, and most of the writers I looked up to. Norman Mailer, Irwin Shaw, James Jones, Eric Maria Remarque, and of course Hemingway, to whom I turned for guidance in all things. Military service was not an incidental part of their histories. They were unimaginable apart from it. I wanted to be a writer myself, had described myself as one to anybody who would listen since I was 16. It was laughable for a boy my age to call himself a writer on the evidence of two stories in a school lit mag, but improbable as this self-conception was, it nevertheless changed my way of looking at the world. The life around me began at last to take on form, to signify. No longer a powerless confusion of desires, I was now a protagonist, the hero of a novel to which I endlessly added from the stories I dreamed and saw everywhere. The problem was, I began to see stories even where I shouldn't, where what was required of me was simple fellow feeling. I turned into a predator, and one of the things I became predatory about was experience. I fetishized it, collected it, kept strict inventory. It seemed to me the radical source of authority in the writers whose company I wanted to join, in spite of their own coy deference to the ugly stepsisters' honesty, knowledge, human sympathy, historical consciousness, and, ugliest of all, hard work. They were just being polite. Experience was the clapper in the bell, the money in the bank, and of all experiences, the most bankable was military service.
Now, how did you become predatory about experience?
It's a way of... I'm describing here a way of standing back from your life and the lives of others, becoming almost by design an observer rather than a wholehearted participant in what's going on. It isn't something that necessarily improves the character, but I have noticed it as a quality in almost every writer I know. You don't tell a writer something that you don't want to read later. And this is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Donald Hall has a poem. I can't remember the name of it now. Oh, yes, I do. Advice to a Young Poet. And in this poem, he counsels the young poet not to be caught in this same trap. And he says, you know, when you go to a funeral, don't be looking around thinking about how you would frame this scene in your poem and how you would create this emotion and recapture this experience. Grieve, he says. Grieve. That's what you're there for. And then after you finish the poem and you're in complete agreement with everything he says, you realize that he has done exactly what he's counseling the young poet not to do in a way. He's taken an occasion of grief and turned it into a poem.
Did you go to Vietnam expecting one day you'd get a book out of it?
I don't remember thinking that exactly, but I probably did have it in mind that I would someday write about it. I know that when I came to write this book, both my brother and my mother sent me letters that I'd written there. And there's something about the very posed and phony quality of those letters that suggests to me that I did indeed have it in mind to write a book about it. They were completely useless to me, in fact, in writing this book, because they were so posed, and so I've had to fall back on what in fact was the right thing for me to use anyway, which was my memory.
What did you say in those letters that strikes you now as so phony?
Well, I didn't mean to be, I think, but when I went over there in 1967, the war already had a kind of cliched quality in the American imagination. You know, the helicopters whopping over the rice paddies and the civilians fleeing the burning village, all that kind of thing that was showing up on the news that was both truth and cliche by the time I got there. But the problem was that it isn't so much that you're trying to deal in cliches as that your mind gets captivated by them without you really being aware of it. And so there was that quality, I think, in the letters that I sent home of basically repeating what everyone already knew anyway and not really seeing what was going on around me. It kind of put a blindfold between me, I think, and the experiences I was having, because they didn't conform to the stereotypical experiences or the experiences that one expected to have over there. And the other thing is, just as a young man, I was, I think, 21 when I went over, there's a certain amount of bravado and posturing in the letters that perhaps is forgivable in a 21-year-old, maybe even natural, but it didn't give me any help in writing this book, because the pose is really intended to obscure rather than to elucidate.
It was about a couple of weeks before you went to Vietnam that you led a parachute jump, and you misjudged.
Oh, yes.
Where you're going to land? Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I was put in charge of another man's team on a training maneuver, and he was called out at the last minute for some reason or other, and I was just back from a year in language school at the time, and I basically, to make it short, was responsible for these men jumping out of a small plane over a burning garbage dump, which I had mistaken for smoke signals, and you can imagine how I endeared myself to them. It also gave something of a promise of things to come, I'm afraid.
See, they landed in this big garbage dump.
Yeah, most
of them did. Because you miscalculated.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of feelings did this give you about your leadership skills?
Well, you might have asked them. I was beginning to have a pretty good idea of my leadership skills by then, I'm afraid. And, you know, I after a couple of years in the Army sent me to officer's candidate school. And because I scored well on these tests, but I should mention that, you know, one of the questions on this test, and I'm not kidding, is how do you pour a glass of beer without raising too big a head on it? And I had a lot of experience pouring glasses of beer, and I was able to answer that question with some accuracy. By answering that question well and others like it, I was passed on to officer's candidate school from the enlisted ranks. I graduated at the bottom of my class. And it wasn't all that miserable a performance, since only about half of us graduated. But I was not intended to graduate. They intended to wash me out, but they discovered right at the end of the training cycle, the 6 months that we spent there, that I was the only one who could, I had been writing these songs for people to sing and organizing a chorus just to amuse myself, and because they needed to stage this kind of review at the end when the class graduated for the post commander and the parents of the graduating officer cadets and whatnot. And they discovered when the moment for the final cuts came that I was the only one who could stage this this farce, and which was, I describe it generously there. And so they kept me on to produce it, and it was and that was how I became an officer in the Army. And it was, you know, the first of many farces that I was to produce as an officer.
One of the stories that you tell in your book is about Thanksgiving of 1968, when you just fixated on the idea that you needed to see the Bonanza Thanksgiving special on a big TV as opposed to the small, crummy TV that you were used to watching. So you took a fairly long, dangerous trip in which you were nearly killed and you did some damage yourself along the way. Why was it so important to watch the Thanksgiving special of Bonanza?
Well, we got very attached to American things over there, as you can imagine we would. And there was nothing more American than Bonanza, with its, you know, majestic landscape and good, commonsensical, taciturn, self-sufficient men, and its heroic values. It was about as different, of course, from Vietnam as anything could be. And I guess that was why we got so drawn into it. But yes, we had this tremendous appetite. You know, people would fly would helicopter pizza into the fields over there for the troops. And you know, that's just one example of thousands I could give of the odd way we tried to bring our home tried to make ourselves at home there.
Now, did you have any feelings about Bonanza when you were in the States before you went to Vietnam?
No, none at all. No, I don't think I ever watched it much. You know, I knew the theme song, but it wasn't an addiction.
So I'll save the really long, complicated story by which you finally got this TV and the strange circumstances under which you actually watched the Bonanza special. But when you did see it, how did it make you feel?
Great. It was worth it, every bit of it. Yeah, it was like making it home, you know.
There's a reading I'd like you to do from early on in the book. I want you to place us.
Okay. This happened really within a day or so of my arrival in the country at the receiving center. There was that night some kind of, as they put it, a probe on the perimeter, and suddenly a lot of weapons were going off and people were running around, and those of us who just arrived didn't know what was going on. No one came to tell us what was going on. We hadn't received our issue of combat gear, so we had no weapons or ammunition, no flak jackets, not even a steel helmet. We were helpless, and nobody knew or cared. They had forgotten about us. More to the point, forgotten about me. In this whole place, not one person was thinking of me, thinking, Christ, I better take a run over there and see how Lieutenant Wolf is doing. No, I wasn't on anybody's mind. And I understood that this was true, not only here, but in every square inch of this country. Not one person out there cared whether I lived or died. Maybe some tender hearts cared in the abstract, but it was my fate to be a particular person, and about me as a particular person, there was an undeniable, comprehensive lack of concern. It isn't true that not one person cared. I cared. It seemed to me I cared too much, cared more than was manly or decent. I could feel my life almost as a thing apart, begging me for protection. It was embarrassing. Truly, my fear shamed me.
Do you think you were alone in that fear? I mean, don't you think everybody else
No.
is probably feeling that too?
No, but we all hid it from each other, and so we all thought we were alone in it, I think. You didn't talk. I mean, you know, it doesn't do any good to talk about being afraid. It doesn't make you any less afraid, and you don't talk about it in a situation like that. But no doubt others were feeling it too. They had to have been.
Terry Gross's guest is writer Tobias Wolff. His new memoir about his time in the Vietnam War is called In Pharaoh's Army. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry Gross's interview with writer Tobias Wolff.
As readers of your first memoir, This Boy's Life, know, and as readers of your brother's memoir, The Duke of Deception, know, your father was a con man who used many different names and made up many different pasts. And when you came back from the war and lived in San Francisco for a while, you got very close with your father for a short while. He'd gotten out of prison while you were in officer candidate school. Why was it easier for you to strike up a good tone with your father during that time when you got back from the Army?
Well, to begin with, Terry, to describe my father as a confidence man is, I think, in some ways to glamorize what he was, because Americans really love confidence men, and even though they pretend not to. But we think of them as being the most American of figures. And the guy with the scheme, the scam, he's just the kind of outlaw version of somebody who started IBM, right? In fact, he was a desperate man whose pathology was to invent pasts for himself so that people would love him, I think. And he never had a real scheme. He never had a plan. He never sold stocks to non-existent companies or anything like that. They were all really kind of improvisational, shall I say, and supremely unsuccessful. And to tell you the truth, I'd always judged him very harshly for this, partly because I recognized in myself some of the same tendencies, in fact, many of the same tendencies. And as I suppose a way of declaring to myself that I was not him, I judged him very harshly and was embarrassed for him and ashamed of him. My own experiences and my own acquaintance with my capacities for behaving in ways that I would not have thought myself capable of, ways in which I had disappointed myself over the years, and particularly in the compass of this book here, basically disabled my will and my ability to judge him. I just didn't want to anymore. I thought, by the time I got back, I was thinking about my own soul and noticing that it had that it needed a lot of work. Less inclined to judge his for that reason, and I think my father felt this, sensed it, and he warmed up tremendously, opened up, and we just became very, very good friends in the time after I got back.
So did this period with your father leave you feeling any different about him or understanding him any better than you had in the past?
Yes, really. He had been always in some ways a rather formidable and even kind of frightening figure to me. And he was, when I knew him after he got out of prison, when I got back from Vietnam, he was a very tender man, very sweet and vulnerable man, who didn't have long to live, though he didn't know that, and I didn't know that, and was just intensely desperate for the love and company of his son, and I was very happy to give it.
When you came home and you started to write, what were you writing about?
When I got home from Vietnam, what was I writing?
Mm-hmm.
I was writing a novel about Vietnam, actually, but you know, it wasn't very good. It wasn't any good at all. But I get, it was just, there was, and what was really wrong with it is it just had nothing at all to do with my experiences there. Again, it was a kind of posed or received picture of it. It was, in an odd way, a way of avoiding thinking about what I had known and been over there. So that, you know, it didn't carry very far, but the important thing for me was that I just started writing again. Just the discipline of writing again meant everything to me.
Chronologically, your new memoir ends with you going to Oxford. You've said that this is going to be your last memoir. Why wouldn't you want to write another one?
Well, I don't know that the kind... my life has been exciting to me since... but in ways that I'm not sure would be exciting to anyone else. My excitements tend to be, frankly, rather intellectual excitements, cerebral, spiritual excitements. And for that reason, I think I'm probably going to trust my imagination to produce the stories that will give me rein for those to express those kinds of excitement rather than the struggle for survival that I guess my first two books is about.
I think I know what you mean, though, about what the problem would be. I know often when I interview somebody, I tend to focus on their more formative years when they're figuring out who they are and
right.
They're making themselves into that person.
Exactly.
And then there seems to be a point where somebody becomes the person who they are, and you have a feeling that, you know, they wake up and they did basically what they did the day before, which doesn't mean what they did was uninteresting or unimportant, but there's
a
kind of sameness, this repetition that,
yes.
that one's life settles into after a certain point.
Yes, exactly.
So that would be hard to dramatize, I
it
guess.
It is. It's harder. It's harder. It does present a challenge. I think an interesting, example of that kind of thing is if you look at Graham Greene's two memoirs, A Kind of Life and Ways of Escape, A Kind of Life is about him, as you put it, in the process of formation. And it's an extremely exciting and peculiar, eccentric autobiography, or memoir, rather, and very coherent. In the second book, he's who he is, and he has different adventures, but the effect is rather episodic, and you don't feel that the personality is at risk at all. The personality is already coherent and determined, so that it does not have the same excitement, I think, as the first volume for that reason, and that would be my hesitation in taking on this kind of a project again. I won't say I would never write nonfiction again. I can imagine writing nonfiction again, the kind of thing, say, that Norman Mailer does in The Executioner's Song, which is a book I love. And, you know, I could go on naming such books. But I think that the world has heard enough from this gentleman for a while on the subject of his early wild years.
Terry Gross spoke with writer Tobias Wolff. His new memoir, In Pharaoh's Army, has been nominated for a National Book Award. The winners will be announced on November 19th. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Coming up, Terry Gross talks with novelist Howard Norman about what attracts him to the isolated, lonely areas of the far north. He spent much of his adult life there and has set two of his novels in that landscape. Norman's latest book, The Bird Artist, takes place in Newfoundland and is based on the true story of an artist who committed murder. The Bird Artist has been nominated for a National Book Award. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Turbulent Indigo, the new release by Joni Mitchell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A jury has recommended the death penalty for Paul Hill in the Florida abortion clinic shooting. The jury convicted the anti-abortion extremist of the shotgun murders of an abortion doctor and his escort in Pensacola. Reporter Debbie Elliott says the final sentencing decision will be left to the judge.
By Florida law, the judge is actually the person who imposes the sentence. He has set a hearing date for later this month and will give Hill and the prosecution an opportunity to present evidence one more time before he imposes the sentence. Florida law does require that he give the jury's recommendation great weight.
Hill, a 40-year-old former minister, was convicted yesterday after the panel deliberated for 20 minutes. Police in Folkestone, Georgia, say a mortar shell has exploded in a high school band room. The blast in the Charlton County High School injured at least 15 children, some of them critically. Police say a youth had taken the mortar shell to school. The space shuttle Atlantis was successfully launched from the Kennedy Space Center today. Atlantis is on an 11-day environmental mission. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Liftoff was delayed briefly as NASA reassessed weather conditions at its overseas emergency landing sites. But once the go-ahead was given, Atlantis soared into orbit against a clear blue sky and a warm Florida breeze. Atlantis will circle the globe at an altitude of 184 nautical miles as the crew gathers data on Earth's atmosphere. Using the Atlas payload of experiments bolted inside the shuttle's cargo bay and the free-flying SPAS platform of instruments, scientists hope to gather information about the middle layer of the atmosphere and how that may contribute to the makeup of the ozone layer. Onboard instruments will also study and measure the energy output of the sun as scientists look for a connection between that and the makeup of gases that envelop the Earth. Among today's spectators at the Cape was French undersea explorer Jacques Cousteau. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
There are 5 days before the election, and Democrats are apparently breathing a little easier, even though Republican polls show more than 60 House races with Democratic incumbents are too close to call. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Judging from the latest polls, Republicans will not take control of the House, but they will see their biggest gain since 1980 and have a good chance of gaining control of the Senate. House Minority Whip Newt Gingrich of Georgia, the man who would be Speaker, entertains visions of GOP gains in the neighborhood of 40 seats. Even Republican pollsters predict no more than a 32-seat gain. Still, Gingrich spends nearly every day planning for the transition to a GOP majority party. That is, when he's not campaigning for other Republicans. Meanwhile, a new poll shows Gingrich is in a surprisingly tight race against former Democratic Congressman Ben Jones. Jones released a survey yesterday showing he trails Gingrich by just 6 percentage points. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
On Wall Street, the stock market closed up 6 points. This is NPR. Experts on aircraft protection are meeting in Washington to study all voice and data reports on the American Eagle commuter flight that crashed this week. They'll compare the information with other accidents involving similar planes. The flight crashed Monday in Indiana, killing all 68 people aboard. Investigators say they're trying to learn more about why the plane suddenly rolled to the right before the crash. The voice recorder suggests the pilots got a warning that the wing flaps were down and the plane was traveling too fast. The Russian Navy charged today an American submarine violated its territorial waters. Brooke Gladstone reports from Moscow.
According to the Russian Navy, an American submarine intruded into its territorial waters at the far northern Kola Peninsula that opens into the Barents Sea, just 25 miles upstream of a top-secret Russian naval base. U.S. defense and intelligence officials have reportedly denied the charge, saying there are no American subs operating in that area. The Russian news agency Interfax quotes Oleg Yeroseyev, the commander of Russia's Northern Fleet, saying that this is the third such violation of Russian waters by Americans in the last 2 years. He says this latest incident undermines the peaceful initiatives undertaken by the two countries and even escalates military tensions at sea. In an incident in 1992, an American sub crashed into a Soviet one in the waters of the far north. Both subs were carrying nuclear weapons. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
The White House says the First Lady won't lead the administration's health care reform effort anymore. Officials say Hillary Rodham Clinton will be replaced by the president's domestic policy advisor and the head of the National Economic Council. Aides say Mrs. Clinton recommended the change because she feels a health care debate has advanced to another stage. Her spokeswoman says the First Lady will continue to play a vital role in reform. A senior White House official also says Mr. Clinton will propose a more moderate health care reform plan next year. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Earlier this week, Terry spoke with Howard Norman, whose new novel, The Bird Artist, has been nominated for a National Book Award. Here's Howard Norman reading the opening paragraph from the book, which introduces his main character.
My name is Fabian Voss. I live in Witless Bay, Newfoundland. You would not have heard of me. Obscurity is not necessarily failure, though. I am a bird artist and have more or less made a living at it. Yet I murdered the lighthouse keeper, Botho August, and that is an equal part of how I think of myself.
The inspiration for The Bird Artist came to Norman in 1979, when he was in Newfoundland researching a local graveyard. He was staying in an old church where he saw a painting of a water bird. When Norman inquired about the artist, he was told it was a man whose story was similar to that of Fabian Voss. Norman was also nominated for a National Book Award for his novel Northern Lights, and he has a collection of traditional Eskimo and Indian stories called Northern Tales. If it sounds like the North is a theme in Norman's writing, it may be because he lived for years in remote areas of northwestern Canada and Greenland. Terry asked Howard Norman to describe the setting of The Bird Artist, a town in Newfoundland in 1911.
Witless Bay is a real place, and it's on the eastern coast of Newfoundland, about an hour's drive nowadays south of St. John's. It's a cod fishing area. This would be before Newfoundland was a province, so it was still under the auspices of British rule. And it is an isolated place. It was even more so then. That is to say that the outside world came in not by radio or not by anything like that, but by schooners. And it was a lobster fishing area, fishing of all sorts, and a very tight-knit, closed community.
You know, your novel is in part about what change or what getting away means for different people. And, you know, I'm thinking in part how for some people really getting away would be moving to a place remote like this, but if you're brought up there, getting away usually means moving away from it.
I did talk to a number of people raised in this town or in others like it. And the one thing that all their accounts of being raised in eastern Newfoundland had in common was the fact that you could think years and years and years, even from your childhood into your young adult years, of how to leave. And yet you wake up one morning and realize, I haven't left. And that some of the characters, one of the things that I like to do is to show how people who are otherwise living in remote areas, isolated areas, through their behavior become even more remote.
You lived for many years in the far north. What initially attracted you to a place that you pretty well could guess was going to be pretty cold, pretty remote?
it's when I was in my middle teens, my home life in Michigan started to collapse. It became somewhat claustrophobic in a number of ways. And I think I started thinking of, as an antidote to that, kind of the most open spaces I could think of. And when I got out of high school, I signed on to work on fire crews up in Manitoba and was surrounded for the first time not just with native people, but with this language this language that wasn't a written language. It was an Algonquin language, and it really represented that other world, that kind of other world view and spiritual world that I had had very little of, and I was tremendously taken by it. And following that, I signed up for a kind of museum apprenticeship program and went further and further north, and before I knew it, I had just taken job after job to write and write children's films, and just about anything that was offered me, I took, and did that for close to 12 years.
I believe you've translated native poems into English.
Yes.
Are there concepts or things that natives have words for that we don't?
Yeah, there's a couple in particular, and there's one story that I've been trying to work on, and it was told to me by a guy named Moses Nukuk. And Moses was a Caribou Eskimo man who lived north of Churchill, Manitoba. And I had worked with him over, three or four years. And I'd been translating a number of shaman stories about very powerful shaman figures. And there's one I've been trying to get, and it has a concept in it which has to do with a visit to his family. And in Inuit, there's phrases which mean things like aunt exhaustion or uncle exhaustion or cousin exhaustion. We all know these things, but we don't necessarily have words for them. That is an idiosyncratic kind of exhaustion caused by relatives.
That's great. How come we don't have a word for that?
Well, you know, I'm searching, and all I can do is use these hyphens, and it's very frustrating, and I'm trying to find the right combinations. But in the story, which is ribald and funny and yet menacing because of this menacing shaman figure, he creates in people, this shaman, the feeling that they have gone through a terribly long, isolated winter with, say, an aunt that they've never liked or an uncle they've never liked. And the power that has is both hysterically funny at times and yet terribly, terribly horrific.
Did you ever want to not only teach some of the natives you were working with English, but teach them selected Yiddish words as well? You know, like, I'm tired of schlepping through the snow.
Well, I was in a very, very, very far north community once, and was at a weather station, and I was calling my grandmother, whose 80th birthday it was, and I was looking at five or six very elderly Inuit women sharing a meal. And my grandmother asked me what the Jewish community was like up there. And I said, I got off the phone and I looked at these women, and they said, so what did you talk about? And I realized I was a failed translator. I couldn't do it. I couldn't translate these cultural sayings, you know.
Writer Howard Norman speaking with Terry Gross. They'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with writer Howard Norman. His novel, The Bird Artist, is set in Newfoundland.
So what was the turning point for you when you decided it's time for me to go back to the States?
In Greenland, in 1980, I was there through the winter in Greenland. I had what I could only describe as about a month-long anxiety attack, and it was just sort of the realization that I was in a place where nobody could come and get me. And it all seemed to be such a highly claustrophobic existence suddenly that I seemed to be tearing at the walls. And that's when I left the North. And then I met my future wife, Jane Shore, who is a wonderful poet in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Phil Levine and Fran Levine introduced us on a Thanksgiving. And when Jane and I got together, she finally said, look, at you know, what do you really want to do? You seem a little bit unhappy with things. And I said, well, I want to write novels. And she said, well, why wait? And so that really set me going, and that really made me feel that I had kind of come full circle. So it really was a deep desire to write. I'd been writing all along. I'd been writing radio plays. I'd been writing journals. I'd been writing short stories, but I didn't show them to anybody.
When you got married and had a family, you have a daughter now, what were there kind of compromises that you weren't used to making because you were so used to living on your own?
Well, I don't think any extreme ones. I think that some of those shifts had been made a couple years earlier. I think it was really a tremendous reprieve from the worry of either being drawn back into my own family, my own first family, my family of my mother and father, which had really more or less completely fallen apart. I have not seen my father in 18 or 19 years now. And also just like anyone else, wondering if you have the capacity to love and be loved. All those things that sound like cliches, but they're very powerful questions in someone's life. And so I think it was more just on the personal level, you know, Terry, rather than worrying about could I travel or would I have this freedom. I do, and I will continue to.
You mentioned that you haven't spoken to your father in about 18 years. And I'm sure this is pretty personal territory that you wouldn't want to go into, but I was just curious if your father tried to track you down after figuring out that his son was becoming well-known and quite esteemed. Your book's up for a National Book Award.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm not sure what he's done. When I say I haven't spoken with him, that's probably doesn't embrace the level of anonymity that he has in my life now. That is to say, there has been no communication, and I guess that's one of the things that happens on occasion between fathers and sons.
In your novel, The Bird Artist, the father in that story just has a complete shift in his life toward the end through actions that I won't really explain because I don't want to give away the pleasures of the mystery part of the story. But did something like that ever happen to your father?
I'm glad you think those parts are pleasurable. I do too, but yes, to put it bluntly, I think that more or less my father was constantly going through large changes. It's just that they weren't often chronicled to us, to me as a child, or even to my mother. I think people go off into the world for periods of times, go through astonishing events and incidents, and come back and don't necessarily ever report it in any way, or it doesn't register in a conversation, even inadvertently. When I read Geoffrey Wolfe's book, The Duke of Deception, about his father who came and went, it truly was a revelation. It truly was a shock to me and a wonderful book for me to read, because while I don't think my father was a con man like Geoffrey's father, I think he had a con man's personality in that he could shift between great ups and downs and shift his moods and act like nothing was wrong when things were wrong, and even when the law was involved, it was as if nothing was wrong. But, you know, a lot of my upbringing was mainly reunions with my father rather than any steady exposure to him. Sometimes the reunions happened after a week, and sometimes it happened after a number of years. And those are really predatory on somebody's senses. That is, they, you know, running into one's father almost as if it was just an inadvertent meeting can really ambush you. I mean, it really is like an ambush on your emotions. Just when you think you are on solid ground, this person comes back. And I have felt a lot more strong about that since being married.
In all the time that you spent with Native cultures in the far north, did you find anyone who had a similar character to your father's? Is there anything comparable?
I found, this doesn't mean I mythologize my father, but I found characters in mythologies who had dual natures, if you will, that were able to lie with great aplomb and great expertise and great verve, and to exaggerate the most pedestrian kind of thing that had happened to them. And there was an entertaining and even charming quality in some of these folkloric characters. But I realized that their roots were very deep in the human psyche. And in those, I recognized my father. I never personally met anyone who would be the north, you know, the northern equivalent of my father. I don't think his behavior was all that uncommon. It is all that uncommon. It's just the only close-up example of it that I've ever known.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for inviting me.
We've been listening to an interview Terry Gross recorded earlier this week with writer Howard Norman. His new novel, The Bird Artist, has been nominated for a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Barbara.
What do you have for us on today's show?
Well, on today's program, lots of news of politics. We'll have a report on the race for governor in Texas. Also, an old Washington story revisited. We'll talk to the authors of the new book about the Clarence Thomas confirmation. And also with Senator John Danforth, who is Justice Thomas's sponsor in that confirmation, who also has a book about that process. And with a look toward the 1994 congressional races, we brought together three political consultants to help us design the ideal candidate for 94.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Turbulent Indigo is Joni Mitchell's 17th album and her first release in over 3 years. Now 50, Mitchell has become an influence on a whole new generation of performers. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of her latest work.
She pulls a shade, it's just another sunny Sunday. She dodges the light like Blanche DuBois. Bright colors fade away on such a sunny Sunday. She waits for the night to fall.
A couple of years ago, I did a review on this show about a bunch of young singer-songwriters I called Junior Jonies, women who had been crucially influenced by the autobiographical musing and idiosyncratic melodies of Joni Mitchell. It got as big a response as any review I've done on Fresh Air, including a request from Joni Mitchell's manager for a tape of the show, because Mitchell was apparently intrigued. Since that time, the league of Junior Jonies has only increased. Listen to Sheryl Crow, Sean Colvin, and Tori Amos, and I'd be surprised if you didn't recognize the same artful meandering that Mitchell pioneered. The thing is, what all her imitators imitate is Mitchell's early phase, her late 60s, early 70s period, which peaked with Blue in 1971. A few albums after that, Mitchell abandoned her most crowd-pleasing style to explore a sort of beat poetry mixed with jazz. She willingly, courageously, and to some of us wrong-headedly, gave up the modes that made her most popular. But on Turbulent Indigo, Mitchell seems to be making peace with her past.
Hard bodies, soft emotions, so fast, so smart. The world is at your feet, but
Longtime Joni Mitchell fans should interpret the title Turbulent Indigo as blue with its dander up. The collection contrasts smooth acoustic-based tunes with lyrics that are vicious attacks on the most prosaic of targets, doctors, lawyers, and pop stars. In the last category, I direct your attention to Not to Blame, a barely disguised condemnation of Jackson Brown, who made the tabloids over the past year for accusations that he hit his girlfriend, actress Daryl Hannah.
The story hit the news from coast to coast. They said you beat the girl you love the most. Your charitable acts seemed out of place. With a beauty with your fist marks on her face. Your buddies all stood by, they bet their fortunes and the fame that she was out of line and you were not to blame.
There's an anger and an all-pervasive bitterness that lends Turbulent Indigo an urgency missing from Joni Mitchell's music over the past 10 years. That anger is often expressed in banal terms. What could be more cliched in the mid-90s than attacking lawyers as greedy and doctors as incompetent hacks? But ultimately, this doesn't negate the potency of the music, much of which can rank among Joni Mitchell's most compelling creations.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Joni Mitchell's new album, Turbulent Indigo.
You wanna make Van Goghs, raise 'em up like sheep. Make 'em out of Eskimo. Make 'em nice and neat. You see 'em with a shotgun there, blooded in the wheat. Oh, what do you know about living in turbulent indigo?
Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, the king of the surf guitar, Dick Dale. His music is now featured in the soundtrack for Pulp Fiction. Also, we hear from Steve Lopez, popular city columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He'll tell us some stories that inspired his column and his novel. I hope you'll join Terry Gross for the next Fresh Air.